rise. The judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
All right, please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of the United States versus Staff Sergeant Ralph J. Hippolyte II, number ACM 39358. In today's oral argument, we consider whether the military judges erred in allowing the government to introduce the charged offenses as evidence of a scheme against the other charged offenses pursuant to Military Rule of Evidence 404B. Pelt's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 8 minutes, please.
All right, that's okay. You may proceed.
Thank you.
Good morning, members of the court, Senior Judge Harding. I know certainly you and I have talked before. The other two judges, I'm not so sure. Judge Hugin, is it pronounced Hugin, Your Honor?
Yes.
Okay, I'm not sure if I've had the privilege of arguing before you. Today we are, as the court just said, my name is William Cassera, and along with Captain Wiseman, we are here to represent Staff Sergeant Ralph Hippolyte. The military judge erred by allowing the government to introduce evidence of the charged offenses as part of a scheme to prove the other offenses in violation of MRE 404B. The military judges allowed the government to conduct an end run around our superior court's decisions in Hills and Who Kills by calling the propensity evidence a common plan or scheme. Because these were sexual offenses, we are talking about the charged offenses, they fall firmly within the prohibition of Hills and Who Kills. Whether one calls it a scheme, a plot, commonalities, or propensity evidence, the end result is the same. By finding, quote, commonalities, unquote, between the charged offenses, what the military judges ended up doing was circumventing the CAF decision in Hills. This de facto permitted the charged conduct to be used as propensity evidence for other charged offenses. There's a couple of points I'd like to make before proceeding into the body of my argument. In their brief, the government argues that at no point did the defense assert that the government was using charged offenses to prove other charged offenses. This is incorrect. Both Hills and MRE 413 were discussed in the context of whether all five specifications could be tried together and whether they could be used as propensity evidence, and that's in the record at pages 48 through 63. In the initial paragraph of the defense's motion, they state that the evidence is inadmissible for any purposes under MRE 404B or 413. The government's assertion that the appellant did not request that the military judges preclude the government from admitting the charged acts under 404B is simply incorrect. And that is also noted by the request for reconsideration, as the court knows, when the second military judge was preparing to deliberate on the case. The trial counsel's closing argument in this case focused on what they called commonalities. It is important to note that under MRE 404B, the term commonalities does not appear anywhere. And as this court knows, other courts, including our superior court, have rejected broad talismanic incantations of words such as intent, plan, or modus operandi offered to secure the admission of evidence of other crimes or acts by an accused at a court-martial under 404B.
Counsel.
Yes, ma'am.
If I may. So are you here before the court today as defense counsel did at the trial level, conceding the 404B issue with regards to specifications 1 through 3?
No. And just so the court is clear, the appellant's position on appeal is that under MRE 404B, the court cannot use charged offenses to prove other charged offenses. If these were uncharged offenses, then arguably the evidence of those two specifications could have been used to prove to prove charged offenses. But when we are dealing with charged offenses, we believe that the clear language of Hills prohibits this court from doing so. But I think it's also important, Judge Hugin, to realize that this court doesn't need to make the broader decision should this court not feel so inclined. Under the specific facts of this case, the 404B evidence that was admitted at trial of charged offenses was used in an improper purpose, and we believe that applies to all of the specifications.
So, counsel, do you have any case law for that proposition you just put forward that it's improper to use evidence of one charged offense to prove another? And I'm thinking in terms of a bench book instruction called spillover, where it actually accounts for that, facts of one charged offense to prove another, where a judge gives the spillover instruction and says, keep each set of evidence to each charged offense separate, and that's the general rule. However, I'm about to give you some limited use or limited purposes that you can do it, which are typically 404B, and it's ending with like, but don't use it as propensity or predisposition. So you just put something out there that I've never heard of before, and it's really trying to extend, is it just within the context of sexual offenses, or are you casting this much wider and just extending Hills and Huckel and really radically changing how 404B works in the typical case?
Yeah. We don't think the court needs to reach the decision as it relates to all offenses. And the reason for that, Your Honor, is you take your typical case at trial in which an accused is charged with a physical assault and stealing of a knife, we'll say. The evidence of the stealing of the knife can be used for the limited purpose of showing that he had the opportunity, for example, to commit the larger offense of murder. In sexual assault offenses, however, Your Honor, as Hills makes clear, that is prohibited. And we believe that that applies to 404B as well.
Now, so what about the case law where it's been simply for the limited purpose of intent or lustful intent? A number of offenses are charged, and the question is, and I think there's a case that goes Cox, where a member came back to the judge and said, hey, if I find in all these offenses a common lustful intent, you know, for specs 1 through 4, can I use that on spec 5? And the court, in their decision, yes, exclamation point. Okay, that goes way back well before Hills and Huckel. But how did Hills and Huckel change that, especially in light of a footnote where they took the time to say, we're not disturbing that. This is really 413. And so I guess my interesting, what I ask here is we're talking 413 when the ruling at trial was made under 404B. Yeah, I take the issue is whether the judge got that right or wrong in terms of what could be used. But you want us to go down the 413 path. And I guess my question is, how was 413 addressed at trial such that we're looking at it now on appeal?
Judge, I did not hear the last sentence.
How was 413 handled at the trial level? Was there any ruling made on 413 to admit evidence or to allow the use of evidence that either of the judges made?
Okay, and Judge, I'll try to answer your questions in order, if I can remember them all. My age, sometimes that doesn't happen. As it relates to your first question, as we found any case law, the closest that we have found is the Contreras case from this court as a post-Hills and Huckel case, which addresses the issue of 404B and 413. Now, it doesn't squarely address the issue, but it does say that the evidence was moved to be admitted under 404B and 413. This court overturned the conviction and said it's not admissible under 413. The court did not address the issue of 404B, but clearly this court had the opportunity to look at the evidence under 404B and declined to do so. As it relates to your second question, Your Honor, while the defense believes that as it relates to this specific case and sexual assault cases in general, the Hills case, 404B presents the same problems and the same constitutional deficiencies as 413 did in Hills. And so if you use 404B to use, as this trial counsel said, commonalities or scheme, then you are creating the same constitutional deficiency that the court, that our superior court said was constitutionally infirm in Hills and Who Kills. Now, does this court need to reach that decision in this particular case? You do not. And the reason why this court does not is because what happened in this case in particular was that the trial counsel used, and the two judges allowed them to use these magical incantations or, as the court said, these talismanic incantations of magical language to circumvent. What did not happen in this case, Your Honor, in your typical 404B case, is at no point did the trial counsel delineate what elements or what facts of any particular specification the other charged specifications were being used to prove. They simply used these broad terms that the CAF specifically addressed in Hills and Who Kills, and that, and I would like to quote from the Fifth Circuit case in U.S. v. Goodwin that we cited in our brief. in which it says that this court has never hesitated to approve the admission of other crimes evidence when the evidence has been relevant under one of the exceptions to the general rule. We have recognized, however, and we must continue to recognize that the various categories of exceptions, intent, design, plan, identity, etc., are not mere passwords, whose mere incantation will open wide the courtroom doors to whatever evidence may be offered in their names.
So, counsel, is your contention then that if propensity and more than one charged sexual offense is at issue in a case, then evidence of that more than one charged offense can never come in under any other rule, including 404B?
Well, the evidence comes in because it's part of the mens rea of the other offenses.
So it can never be used under any other rule, including 404B?
I'm always loath to say questions like any other rule, because I'm sure that there is some rule out there. And Judge, again, while that is the appellant's contention, we do not believe that this court needs to reach that position in order to decide this particular case.
So I think I understand you're saying this was propensity evidence masquerading as common plan, scheme, or even pattern. That word was used too. But I'm backing up for a second and recognizing that all the evidence was admissible, correct? Because each of it was admissible to a specific offense.
Absolutely.
No, okay. And so all we're talking about is how the fact finder, in this case, the military judge, could use the evidence, and also the parties argue the evidence, but more importantly, I think, how the fact finder could use the evidence. But in this case, we don't have the benefit of oral instructions given on the record or written instructions given on the record. We just have a fleeting glimpse of what the judge was kind of thinking before he went back to deliberate. So my question is, the military judges, both appellate and trial, are presumed to know the law and apply it correctly. How should we consider that factor in reviewing this case?
Well, I think that's a very important question, Your Honor. There are two responses. One is, who kills was a judge alone case. That military judge was presumed to know the law. And secondly, in this case, the other presumption that we make is that we believe the military judge, when he takes us at his word and says, I am going to use this evidence for this purpose. It is that purpose which is improper. So the fact that the military judge is presumed to know the law, yes, he's also presumed to know, that we are presumed to believe that he applies the law as he said he would at trial. And the way that he said that he was going to use it at trial is improper. What did not happen in this case, Your Honor, is what the courts have always required under 404B, which is that an exception be carefully carved out of the general rule to serve a limited purpose and a limited judicial and prosecutorial purpose. Your Honors, there's a case that one of my favorite quotes from an Army case that's not relevant in the general terms, but it is not one of the term language of that case is it is not up to the appellate court to perform a CPR rescue mission. It is not up to this court to now go back and say, well, this element could have been used or this fact could have been used to prove this element at trial. That did not happen. The burden was on the government as the proponent of the evidence to put forth the evidence and to say, this is why we are using it. They did not do so. All the government did is these broad statements using terms such as commonalities and scheme, which are nearly thesaurus synonyms for the term propensity. As such, the military judges abused their discretion in finding that the evidence established a common plan or scheme.
So
I don't want to get too deep into please, Your Honor.
If we skip ahead and if we assume that it was abuse of discretion for the judge to use this evidence under 404B, then what test do we apply when we examine that abuse of discretion?
You apply the same test that the court did in Hills, which is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, as it is constitutional error. It is constitutional error because it I'm not sure what term I'm looking for, but it gave the government a pass around the constitutional standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The exact same issues, the exact same infirmaries that our superior court found in CAP would be applicable here.
So make sure I understand. So typically, evidentiary issue 404B, non-constitutional error, apply substantial influence tests with regard to that error. How did it affect the verdict?
Weigh
four factors. You're saying, in this case, because it was used as propensity in sexual offenses and really was 413 issue, we should adopt the Hills.
You use the same same analysis as Hills. If it is error to admit the evidence under 404B, then this court must test for prejudice, and that is I'm sure I'm butchering this person's name more than Judge Hugan's name, but it's Yamin, I believe, and that is whether the constitutional error is tested beyond harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. There are several things that the court should look at in doing so. One is the strength of the government's case. As we point out in assignment of error two, and appellant's position is that the proof in this case was extremely weak. And this also goes to the second factor, which is the strength of the defense case. Third is, and I think perhaps most importantly, is the materiality of the evidence. And this again, Your Honor, goes to what element did any of these facts and these other charged offenses make more or less probable? And we simply don't have anything on the record that establishes that from the government's point of view. So it is not up to this court to presume or to resurrect the government's case in that regard. And finally, the quality of the evidence. And again, this was purely testimonial evidence. Judge Pasha, did you have a question?
I don't.
I'm sorry. We can liken this to those cases in which the trial counsel's reliance on the evidence in closing shows that the evidence was not harmless. Here, the trial counsel, while she never used the words propensity, in closing used the words commonalities, scheme, which was obviously a pretext. Obviously, Your Honor, the prosecutor's not post-Hills, and as I recall the facts of this case, Hills came out sort of in between the motions hearing and trial on the merits, so obviously the trial counsel was not going to say, this is propensity evidence. They're forbidden from doing so. But with all due respect to the government in this case, these terms are the exact same, commonalities and scheme. At no point did the government look into or address the specific elements of the specific case.
But counsel, the factors that you just described for presenting to the court for our analysis are the factors for testing for non-constitutional. But just to be clear, your contention is that because propensity was at issue in this case, we should be testing for constitutional error?
Yes, Your Honor. I just want to make, I'm sorry, and I apologize if I conflated the two. We believe that the result is the same either way, but we believe that this court should test for constitutional error because the evidence, because the error on the military judge's part was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
So we're down to 10 seconds, but one last question. Again, given it's judge alone, and all he did was give a preview of what he was going to consider as far as the legal, the law, the case, instructions in the case. My question is, what about potentially other 404B purposes? Did the judge have the discretion to work through that and say, for example, in spec 3, the issue element of intent, the fact that the defense argued against lack of evidence of intent as a spec 3 and others, but then look at the other specifications, that evidence, and say, hey, I see evidence of intent in spec 1, spec 2, 4, and 5. Could he have said, you know what, I'm going to look at that and consider it for its tendency, if any, to prove his intent to gratify a sexual desire with regard to spec 3. And I'm not going to use it for propensity because I'm a good judge and I follow the law. And so could that judge have done that properly in this case?
Again, Your Honor, we sort of are taking two positions in this case. I want to make it clear. Our position is that that post-Hills, 404B evidence is inadmissible. But again, if this court does not wish to address that issue, and we understand that, then in specific as it relates to these cases, had the government put on evidence of those specific reasons that they wanted to put that evidence on, and had the military judge made the conclusions that the senior judge is making, then clearly we're having a different discussion at this time. But that's not what happened in this case. What happened in this case is they painted it with a broad brush, just like in Hills, and just used other words. As a result, the appellant requests that the charges and specifications be dismissed.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Government counsel, you may proceed.
Is
Senior Judge Harding, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Mike Bunnell. Ms. Mary Ellen Payne and I represent the United States in this proceeding. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in this case because he considered the charged acts for a legitimate 404B purpose. But even if that consideration was improper, appellant suffered no prejudice. And that's really the extent of my arguments today, that one, there was no 404B error, and two, there was no prejudice. But before I get to those points, there's a sort of threshold issue I want to develop that I think is pivotal to a clear understanding of this case, and I think will reduce some of the white noise. And that is that Hills and 413 and propensity evidence in this case, under these facts, is actually a red herring, and that we can remove it from the analysis. And I reached that conclusion for a couple of reasons. One is Senior Judge Harding's point, and that this is a military judge alone proceeding, where we have Erickson and Mason and a slew of other CAF cases saying he's presumed to understand the propensity ban. He's presumed to know that he cannot use these things for a propensity purpose. But much more important than that, the record in this case is replete with examples that the judge did in fact understand the propensity ban, that he knew exactly how not to use this evidence. And I want to draw just one to your attention. This is on page 5 of Appellate Exhibit 6. This is the ruling on the severance motion, specifically dealing with the 404B analysis. And so the judge has gone through the Reynolds test. And now he pivots, and he's using his own language to describe the dilemma. And he says this. He says, the general risk is that the fact finder will treat evidence of uncharged acts as character evidence and use it to infer that an accused has acted in character and thus convict. Now, appellant's position is that the judge succumbed to the same risk he just described, that despite the fact that here and in several other places in the record, he's gone through and with surgical precision carved out exactly what not to do, their position is that he did it anyway. And what I'm trying to say here is when you boil it down, whether we call it an end run or whether we call it a synonym or what have you, it's a bad faith argument. If he knew what not to do, but did it anyway, that's a bad faith argument. And there is no evidence of bad faith in this case. In fact, again, the record is abundant with evidence that he was acting in good faith. And I want to point your attention to just one example of good faith, and that's on page 48 through 50 of the record. This is the oral section of that same severance motion where trial counsel is presenting its argument for why they need to be together. And then the judge engages in this little repartee with him and stops him and says, listen, trial counsel, you're saying that if we sever these charges, these specifications, that they're definitely propensity evidence, that this is clearly showing that he has a proclivity to abuse people in their sleep. But you're saying that they need to be put together and that we're going to use them specifically for 404B only. Trial counsel, doesn't that present a problem for the members who are trying to distinguish between these two? And so my point being is here's a really clear example that the military judge is acting in good faith. I mean, this isn't a charade. He understands very clearly what the problem is and what not to do with the evidence. And because he has that understanding, it allows us to say, okay, he knew what not to do. He was acting in good faith. We can take the question of propensity in Hills and 413 off the table. And we just look at, did he get 404B right or wrong? And if he got it wrong, is there prejudice?
Counsel, on getting 404B right, I'm looking at the acquittal specification, specification 2 involving Staff Sergeant S.A.K. And the first prong of the Reynolds test is that the judge has to find, or the fact finder could have found by preponderance of the evidence that the offense had occurred, I guess. Do you think that the judge abused discretion in finding that in spec 2 that was an acquittal, or do you think the judge did not abuse his discretion?
Absolutely did not abuse his discretion, Your Honor. And I think here's where we get to that point. I mean, the test is, could a reasonable jury member under the circumstances find by a preponderance of the evidence? So there's a difference between finding something beyond a reasonable doubt, and you know, there's a different standard of proof there. But again, these are charged acts. This is a unique situation. We have presumably a referral of charges, an Article 32 hearing, a referral of charges, and then we have testimony of these things happening. And then we have these individuals confronting the accused and saying, hey, we know you're doing these things to us. And so could a reasonable jury member have found by a preponderance of the evidence that these things happened? Absolutely. And the judge goes through that analysis in significant detail. And I want to come back to that point of the judge's analysis, because as we enter the Reynolds test and the 404B question, it's important to recognize that this is an abuse of discretion standard, and it is a strict one. It calls for more than a mere difference of opinion. It can't be, the decision can't be arbitrary, fanciful, clearly unreasonable, or clearly erroneous, but if it's not those things, then it's good. And here we have, I think, two of the three prongs to the Reynolds test that are relatively low hurdles. The first one is what we've just addressed, and that, yes, he's gone through with each of these specific 404B issues and said a reasonable jury member could find that this has happened. And so that, again, there's testimony from the victims on that point. There's the confession to that point. So that is a low hurdle. I think we're clear over that. The other one that's a relatively low hurdle is the issue of the balancing test, the 403 balancing test. Because again, this is a judge alone proceeding. He's presumed not to get confused by the issues, to not hold something unfairly prejudicial against the appellant. So it drops the risk of prejudice very low. And more than that, he actually put his probative or his 403 balancing test on the record, which
so
we learned from
then skipping then to the middle prong, the second prong of the Reynolds test. What fact of consequence is being made more or less probable?
The common plan, which really speaks to the element of intent. But that the judge hitches his wagon, and I think he did it exactly right, to the idea of a common plan or scheme.
So common plan or scheme, if we take the words of the government in their findings argument, it's summarized, I believe, very succinctly as this case is about an NCO who preyed upon his friends, who took advantage of his friends when they were in vulnerable positions, when they were asleep, had been drinking, were unaware and unable to protect themselves from him. To the extent that that is a solid and concise summary of the government's position as to the common scheme or plan, and understanding that specifications 1, 2, and 3 are founded basically on that charging theory, because they all use the term of the alleged victim being asleep, specifications 4 and 5 fall apart from that. There's no reflection that there's that similar charging theory in specifications 4 and 5, because in specifications 4 and 5, it's that it's a bodily harm theory that was charged. And to the extent that the government's findings argument was a good summary of the common plan or scheme and the victims being unaware and unasleep, or excuse me, unaware and asleep, factually, that's simply not true of the victim in specifications 4 and 5. If all of that's true, how does the common scheme and plan carry from specifications 1, 2, and 3 into specifications 4 and 5?
Fair question, Your Honor, and the answer is yes and no. So yes, I think that the common plan does carry, and yes, there is a difference between specifications 4 and 5 and 1, 2, and 3, but I don't think it's fair to say that the common plan and scheme of this issue of being unaware is not in play. With Airman J.D., for whom the specifications 4 and 5 are relevant, those are his specifications, the testimony was that he brought him upstairs, that he was pretty drunk, pretty intoxicated, and that it appeared to be asleep at the time, and that this individual climbed on top of him, straddled him, and started massaging him. And so the question, again, of whether or not there was a common plan or scheme, I think the question is absolutely yes. And I think all we need to do is look to Reynolds to find that. So in Reynolds, we had that, this was the Top Gun case, where the pilot would bring these girls home, show them a slideshow, and have his way with them whether they wanted to or not. And they looked at it and they said, well, generally, we're not going to use specific intent unless it's challenged.
Well, I understand that specifications 4 and 5 are essentially the charging theory is bodily harm and therefore lack of consent. But that's not the charging theory in specifications 1, 2, and 3. And in fact, the victim's own statement from the beginning when they first made the report through his testimony at trial, the victim in specifications 4 and 5 always recollected that he had had a conversation with appellant before the incident that was charged in specification 4. So there was never any contention or even any assumption or inference that the victim of specifications 4 and 5 was unaware or asleep at the time that the incident charged in specification 4 occurred. Isn't that correct?
Well, again, yes and no. So I think what we're confusing.
And so isn't that fatal to the common scheme or plan carrying through from specifications 1, 2, and 3 into 4 and 5?
No, Your Honor. I think the issue is we're confusing the questions of charging theories with 404B admissibility theories. Just because they've charged it one way doesn't mean it's not admissible for a 404B purpose.
But factually, you don't have it either. And I believe the charging in this case was a reflection of the facts in this case. And because you don't have a victim who is unaware or asleep at the time that specification 4 incident occurs, the common scheme or plan, one of the essential facts that you need to describe it as a common scheme or plan, simply doesn't exist in the incidents charged in specifications 4 and 5.
So let me develop that thought. I see your point, and I wanted to develop what I was saying beforehand because I think it's helpful and instructive to what we're doing. The common plan or scheme and how we define that is really important. And so if this individual was maybe not actually asleep, but they are there laying on the floor, or it's on the bed in charge for, or specification 4 and 5 is laying on the bed, presumably trying to sleep. In fact, that's what he does say, is I'm trying to go to sleep. And he is intoxicated. He needs help up the stairs. The common plan of saying, hey, this is somebody that finds his friends vulnerable, intoxicated, trying to sleep, if not actually asleep, and then he has his way with them, presumably hoping that they don't recollect it the next day, then that is the common plan or scheme. And more importantly, the question here pivots a little bit because the defense opens the door. And this is what I was trying to get at with Reynolds. Is Reynolds was saying, yeah, okay, you don't generally get to talk about specific intent until the defense opens the door to it, and they're putting on a consent defense. Well, they put on a consent defense for specifications 4 and 5, so we can use that common plan to say, hey, listen, he had a specific plan to have sex with this individual, have a sexual engagement, whether they consented to it or not. And that's exactly the holding in Reynolds. And so, yeah, does it carry through? Are they factually a little bit different? Absolutely. But does the common plan or scheme carry through, and can it be used for a legitimate 404 purpose? Absolutely as well. And again, I think, Desharding, you have a question, sorry.
Yes, I do.
Okay, please.
So, and it's back to the purposes that are being talked about here. Again, the record, common plan or pattern is what the first judge kind of talked about in his rulings on the severance. The second judge, who was the fact finder, said, I adopt all that, but I'd probably go with scheme instead of common plan, I think is what he said. So my question is, does that matter? How much does the purpose being put forward in this case under 404 matter at the end of the day? And a related question, much like I asked appellate's counsel, given we have a military judge, presumably the law, was he at liberty to look at this, apply the law, and find other permissible 404B purposes to use it for, i.e., such as intent?
So let me try to answer both questions, Your Honor. To the first question of whether the nomenclature is important, I think the answer is no. I mean, whether you call it a scheme or a plan, I don't think it much matters. In fact, that's exactly what Acton and Castillo were talking about when they're saying, listen, we don't need to fit it snugly into the pigeonhole of one of these 404B offenses. As long as it's being used for a non-propensity purpose, that's the only test. And so that, I don't think that matters, common scheme or plan. And with regard to the second question of whether the military judge could have used this for some other purpose besides common plan or scheme, I think that those cases are equally helpful. That as long, the test is it's used being used for a non-propensity purpose. If it's non-propensity, it is legitimate according to Acton and Castillo. And so yeah, I think that would be completely appropriate in this case. And you can see the dilemma is because these ideas they overlap. What is a plan versus a scheme versus a motive versus an intent? They seem to be imbricated in some way. And so what the court seems to be at pains to explain to us is, yeah, we get it, that it's a bit of a hodgepodge. You can relieve yourself of the burden of having to use the precise right language as long as you can demonstrate that it's exactly a non-propensity purpose. And with respect to that purpose, I think the judge hitched his wagon to two very important cases, and that is Munoz and Johnson. And some historical background that led up to these cases is, I think, important, because we've talked already about some of the dangers of 404B that we saw in Brannon and other cases where they said, listen, we don't want to use words like intent and plan for broad, talismanic incantations to just sweep it in under the name of propensity evidence and just give it this cover. We don't want to do that. But then later these cases came about, specifically Munoz and Johnson, and they said, sir, we don't want to do that. That's wrong. But if there is a common plan, if there is a cognizable, a defined and coherent design to what this individual is doing, well, that is a live and well 404B purpose. And in those cases, I think the information is incredibly helpful. Because what we had there is the fact patterns are strikingly similar for Munoz and Johnson. You had a father abusing a daughter, and that was the charged act. And they brought in a second daughter to say something similar happened to me. And what the judges did in both of those cases is they lined up the 404B and the charged act, and they said, what are the commonalities? How similar are they? And in Munoz, they went through specific factors, which Johnson later adopted, which is, what is the age of the victim? What are the relationship with the victim? Where did this happen? What kind of circumstances surrounded the assault itself? Was the contact similar? And what we see in our case is the judge went to Munoz, lifted that analysis, and plopped it under the facts of this case and lined it up perfectly. And again, remember, the issue is, did he abuse his discretion? Was his decision arbitrary, fanciful, clearly unreasonable, or clearly erroneous? And it wasn't. He went through with each specific 404B act, and he said, look, we can fit it in here. We're looking at the age of these individuals. They're all about the same age, about the same rank. We're looking at where this is happening. For lack of a better term, it's in something of a sleepover setting, where it's either they're crashing at his house, or he's at their house, or they're at a hotel room. And then they're looking at the circumstances surrounding the assault. And they're saying, and the judge looks back and says, they're strikingly similar, especially those first three, where you have, they're drinking all night. And then it's in the middle of the night. He waits until they are asleep or appear to be asleep. He comes over and he undoes their pants surreptitiously, and he starts to molest their genitals. And then when people catch him at it, he scurries away and tries to get out of trouble.
And of course, all of those things that you just described, again, as I pointed out earlier, don't hold true for the specification 4-5 incident as they do for the specifications 1, 2, and 3 incidents. That having been said, returning to Senior Judge Harding's question and that point, does the government contend then that if the judge is using 404B, and as long as it's not a propensity basis, right, the use that the judge is applying 404B in order to consider more than one charge of charged misconduct, does the basis have to be common amongst all of the charges and specifications? So for example, could you, maybe not in this case, but in some other case where you have five specifications, could you use one 404 non-propensity basis to tie together specifications 1 through 5, and then a different 404B basis to tie together 2 and 3, and then a different basis to tie together 3 and 4? Or does, in order to use 404B, a non-propensity basis in that way, does it have to be a shared basis among all of the charges and specifications that the judge is saying he's going to consider using under 404B?
So let me make sure I'm understanding the question right, Judge Hugh. So the first, if I'm understanding it right, is do we only have to fit it in one, but does it have to fit neatly into one bucket?
Correct.
Okay, the answer to that is clearly no. That's exactly what Acton and Castillo are saying. They're saying we don't care about fitting it snugly into the pigeonhole of one of these things. First of all, it's not an exhaustive list. But the test that they say right after that, in both of those opinions, they say that the only test is whether it's non-propensity evidence. And so whether or not, and again, I think it's troubling because we can see them groping for language to describe what's happening. Whether we call it a plan or an intent, I mean, these are really related ideas. But the point is as long as the judge is using it for a non-propensity purpose, it's permissible. There's nothing saying he can't use two purposes. So absolutely he could.
All right, counsel, let's suppose that we found the judge did use evidence of other charged offenses for at least one offense as propensity, and there was an error that was made, in other words. Then why shouldn't we test the prejudice for harmless beyond reasonable doubt as appellate's counsel suggests?
Well, it's because there's no constitutional issue in this case. So Hills is what basically said, hey, listen, we've got charged acts. There could erode the presumption of innocence And so it raises this constitutional question. That's just not in play here. In fact, the Hill's opinion itself is what points us away from that idea. I'm going to just cite really quickly the language that's pertinent on this point. It says, this is on page 356 of Hill's. It says, it is antithetical to the presumption of innocence to suggest that conduct of which an accused is presumed innocent may be used to show a propensity to have committed other conduct of which he is presumed innocent. Now, I don't think that we have to even address the question of propensity. So it's not, did he get 404B wrong? It's only if it's used for affirmatively for a propensity purpose, that's when the presumption of innocence comes into play. Otherwise, the analysis is material prejudice, substantial right, just as it's described in Haro. But that's not the case here.
Assume that it is for a moment, that this was improperly admitted, or the use was not improper under 404B, and it was, in fact, propensity masquerading as something else. And so I'm asking you, if we were to find that, what is the standard for prejudice we should apply in this case?
Yes, if there is constitutional error, then it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the standard.
So you're saying whenever there's propensity, it's improper propensity, it's constitutional error?
Didn't
people mess up 404B long before Hills and Huckel and misuse that evidence as propensity, and it was still non-constitutional substantial influence on the verdict test? Isn't that what it was, still is, maybe?
So let me just make sure I'm understanding the question, Your Honor. So if they fell victim to the Hills problem and they use this affirmatively as propensity
evidence. It can be a 404B problem too, though, right? That's what it's about. 404B says, don't use it this way. It's not predisposition, but here are the exceptions. So propensity is always right there being a major concern of 404A. 404B, exceptions, right? And so what I'm saying is that this was violated well before you even had a 413 or a Hills or a Huckel. And the courts had to figure out how to deal with it in cases where it was misused as propensity or they found that. And my question is anything different today in terms of the standard to apply in assessing the prejudice for that error?
Fair question. I think I understand now. There's a disjunct between the way they treated Hills and the way they treated 404B evidence in the past. And I think my answer is, listen, under either test, whether we go with either one of them, there is no prejudice in this case. Because the fact is, you've got these individuals describing really compelling circumstantial evidence.
You're saying that if this was used as propensity, pick any of these convictions, that there's no real possibility that propensity would contribute to the verdict. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly, Your Honor. And that is for a couple of reasons. I think the primary piece is...
Even with regard to specification one, where there's no direct evidence of any genital touching, it's just based on someone's vivid dream and a sense of wetness of their penis at some point. I mean, isn't 404B filling a big gap there in this case for the government?
I don't think so, Your Honor. It's because that particular specification where you have Sergeant R.W., he is one of four individuals that confronts the appellant later and says, listen, we know you're molesting us in our sleep when we're drunk. Cut it out. To which he says, I'm sorry, I do weird things when I'm drunk. Whether we want to split hairs and call that a tacit admission or some dodging the question, he just confessed to the crime. And that is an insurmountable problem of evidence for the defense. When you couple that with the circumstantial evidence of his testimony, it is proof beyond a reasonable doubt, even if you pull propensity out of the equation. Your Honor,
and of course, even if one interprets what the appellant said in that intervention or whatever you want to call that meeting with his friends, is there was no discussion of the facts or what was eventually charged as specification one, which was a touching of the genitalia. There was no admission to that during the intervention.
There's no admission to the specific facts of the case? Absolutely not. Yeah, I mean, the conversation was what it was. But it's also, I don't think that necessarily undermines the potency of the evidence. I mean, what you have here is him saying, we know what you've been doing to us. And they didn't charge it as mouth contact. They just charged it as specifically abusive sexual contact. And so it doesn't matter whether he touched it with his mouth or with his, the point is they said, you've been touching us. And he said, yeah, I'm sorry, I do bad things when I'm drunk.
So if we, following up on Senior Judge Harding's question, if we found that it was an abuse of discretion for the judge in terms of his application of 404B to the findings of guilty in this case, and if we applied the non-constitutional error test that the government puts forward and summarizes and cites from Harrow, the finding in Harrow, or the opinion in Harrow. Could you explain to me then, based on the strength of the government's case with regards to specifications 4 and 5, the entirety of the government's case in specifications 4 and 5 seems to be the alleged victim's testimony. And this is a victim who has no memory of how he came to be unclothed or undressed. He has no memory of how he came to be completely repositioned on the bed, and he has no memory of how he came to be essentially suspended over appellant.
And so your question is if you pull out the 404B evidence, is there enough to still convict beyond a reasonable doubt?
Right, based on the strength of the government's case with regards to specifications 4 and 5.
Well, I think the strength of the government's case is only one of those elements. I think the other ones are the strength of the defense's case, the materiality of the evidence, and the quality of the evidence is the fourth Harrow factor. But I think it's important to recognize there that, again, in that case, the day after, when he's confronted about it, in the messages, he says, "I take full responsibility for what happened." That's a really damning admission. It seems to suggest exactly what he said, that this wasn't consensual. And so, yeah, I think that there is still, even if you pull that piece out of the equation, that there's still evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that he wasn't prejudiced by this. And I'm sorry, Your Honors, the clock is doing weird things. It keeps going up and down. I don't really know how much time I have.
3 minutes and 23 seconds.
Okay, great. And that, again, when you couple this, you know, we're here in the prejudice world, and that's really the last piece of the analysis, is was he prejudiced by it? And those are the things to keep in mind, is that you have two separate confessions, and then you have separate testimony by four different individuals. And when you go, and just to make one more quick point about the commonalities between these things, when you looked at the Johnson and Munoz case, you had two people. You had four people, and one of which wasn't even on the charge sheet, by the way, but the military judge was no issue with that, military judge considering that evidence and not using it for propensity purpose. But so here we have four different individuals describing oddly similar circumstances. This is really, really compelling evidence of a common plan or scheme, that it was developed, that this wasn't something that he just whimsically decided to do. But with regard to prejudice, that confession, both to Airman J.D., and then when the four individuals confront him, those confessions coupled with the testimony is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. If I could briefly conclude. Propensity is really not at issue in this case because the military judge knew better. In fact, he's presumed to know better legally. The judge properly applied the Reynolds test, finding that appellant had a defined, coherent scheme to wait for his friends until they were drunk and asleep or appearingly asleep, and then surreptitiously molesting them. But even if the judge should not have considered these acts as a coherent plan, appellant suffered no prejudice because he confessed to these crimes, corroborating the abundant circumstantial evidence. As such, this court should affirm the findings and sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Appellant's counsel may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you.
It's 8 minutes. 8 minutes.
Your Honors, I'd sort of like to look at this case as a funnel. I'd like to address a very larger picture and then funnel it down to the much smaller picture, if the court would indulge me. The government quotes from United States versus Hills, and in that exact quotation that they use, there's also a footnote in Hills to that quotation which says, "The fact that no presumption of innocence attaches to uncharged misconduct is why the use of charged misconduct as propensity evidence is analytically distinct from uncharged misconduct." So if we look at this in the bigger picture, which is whether or not 404B evidence in general can be used in sexual assault cases post-Hills, it's important to look at two things, or four things rather. First off is the structure of the rule. Both of them require notice. Two, it allows in otherwise admissible evidence, here the evidence of crimes was admissible because they were charged. Three, the language of the rule clearly relates to other charged crimes or other, excuse me, not charged, other crimes, wrongs, or acts. And four, as just noted in that footnote, the presumption of innocence does not apply when you are using one charged offense to prove another. The court asked me, senior judge asked me early on whether or not we had found any other cases, and I think it's important to also realize that in the federal system, there's a different charging system, which is why we don't see federal cases addressing this issue. In the federal system, they charge the offenses separately. The government holds all of the keys to a case like this. The government controls all the charging decisions. The government could have severed these charges. The government could have tried all of these charges separately. It is not for the appellate courts to decide for which purposes the improperly admitted evidence could have been admitted. So taking that funnel and looking at the 404B question in general, first assertion is that Post-Hills, and we believe the Contreras case from this court supports that, that Post-Hills, you cannot use charged misconduct under 404B in sexual assault offenses. But again, this court does not need to
so
reach.
Counsel, how do you reconcile that then with 413C, that this rule, meaning 413, does not limit the admission or consideration of evidence under any other rule?
Well, again, Your Honor, that's pre-Hills.
But it remains the language of the rule.
It does remain the language of the rule, but that's
and
why I'm
Hills,
saying.
And in Hills, CAF footnoted that they weren't speaking to the application of other rules, and they specifically mentioned 404.
Yeah, but if you look at that footnote, Judge, I think that it does not say what the government, and I'm trying to pull it up real quick, it does not say what the government wants it to say. And unfortunately, I don't have the footnote right in front of me. But again, Your Honor, the defense position is, as we take that funnel, let's go a little bit further down the funnel now. Let's take the judge's assertion and say, okay, we disagree, 404B can apply in sexual assault offenses, in sexual assault cases. Then you take that funnel a little bit lower and you look at, well, Judge Eugen, you asked the questions about if this evidence is not, that this common plan, scheme, intent, whatever talismanic incantations the government tried to use, even if it applies to specifications 1 through 3, it doesn't look like it applies to specifications 4 through 5. So the government's response to that is, well, it is admissible because he sexually assaults these people, so he sexually assaults other people. Well, that is clearly propensity evidence. So as we go down that funnel and we look at it, taking the big picture of 404B out and looking now at the specifics of this case, what the government encouraged the military judge to do and what the military judge appears to have done, at least according by the first military judge's ruling, is to use these as intent. And Senior Judge Harding mentioned the first use of the, by the terminology of the first judge. We believe the nomenclature, the wording, is important. If we are having, at the appellate level, this much difficulty pigeonholing this 404B evidence into a permissible purpose, then the obvious conclusion from the appellant standpoint is because it was improperly used. We wouldn't have these problems with characterizing the evidence had it been properly admitted by the government at trial. And as I noted, the government makes the charging decisions. The government could have said, as Judge Eugen asked, we are using this fact to prove this portion of 404B in this specification. That is the way that the government could have chosen to attack this case. They did not. It is not, as I said earlier, up for the appellate courts to conduct CPR on the government's case and say, well, it could have been used for this reason, although we don't know that it was. We will take the government and the military judge at their word, and that word seems to be a very broad incantation applying to all 5 specifications. The government discusses Munoz and Jackson at great length. And I could be wrong, but my recollection is that the other offenses that they were using were uncharged misconduct in those cases. Again, a very different animal. but again, all pre-Hills and pre the Contreras decision from this case. But as appellant asserted earlier and in his brief, what happened here is clearly what Hills and Reynolds say should not happen, which is the government throws out these large terms and says, we are using them for these purposes. The military judge says, okay, I will accept them for these purposes. Those sort of broad, talismanic, I love that term, talismanic incantations are impermissible both under Reynolds and under Hills. So Judge Ugin, this court doesn't need to reach the bigger decision as to whether or not 404B prohibits this evidence in all sexual assault cases. What this court can look at is Reynolds in particular, how the government introduced this evidence with these very broad brush strokes and how the military judge said that he was going to use it. And based on that, we believe that this court should reverse the appellant's convictions and dismiss the charges. Subject to further questions of the court, this concludes the appellant's presentations.
So I just have one follow-up based on something that you brought up with regard to presumption of innocence. Again, dynamics of this case, we've got evidence from charged offenses potentially being used under 404B for another charged offense, right? And the point is, for all those offenses, there's a presumption of innocence. And so are you saying that there's a problem here with the, what I refer to as the gatekeeping function of the judge side of the brain? It says, is this admissible and for what use? And here's how I go through that. And it says Reynolds test, find by preponderance. And then somehow with the judge again, getting to the findings and saying, okay, now it's all beyond reasonable doubt, which is some of that confusion when all that was just tossed in the lap of court members initially in Hills and say, you know, if you find by preponderance, then you can use it to determine beyond a reasonable doubt, same information. Is that what you're getting at in a sense to kind of get you to an issue of constitutional dimension?
It is, Your Honor, much as in Who Kills, where the military judge did the same thing.
Okay, I have no other questions. All right, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, thank you both for your arguments. The court will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.